Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by John Bryce of USA Today and Pete Sampson of The Athletic. Pete, I wanted to start with you today because you and Matt Fortuna for the Independent podcast had an interview with Brian Kelly. I do not know if that coincided with a colonoscopy for you or not, but I assume that you eschewed that and just talked to Notre Dame's former head coach. And that's a great get for journalists to get Brian Kelly to come on and talk, especially now that he's kind of entering the media and no longer with LSU. Might have been a different get at that point, Pete.
Yeah, it would have been a different story. But yeah, I did appreciate Matt Fortuna working the colonoscopy into a reference into the interview itself. BK found that pretty funny. Yeah, it was just, I think the question I wanted to ask him most was like, if Notre Dame was set up the way that it's set up right now, would you have left? And I'm talking about NIL, undergrad transfers, reclassification of recruits is okay. You know, facilities obviously are at a completely new spot. Coaching salaries, if you think back, and I should have referenced this directly to him, like the Mike Elko situation. We went to Texas A&M. No, he's coming back. No, he's going to A&M. No, he's coming back. No, he's, and then he goes to A&M, obviously. Because I don't think Brian would have left that Notre Dame, but I also think that Notre Dame wouldn't have existed today if Brian hadn't left, if that makes sense. But when I put that question to him, he was like, oh boy. And so you could, I think it was a good question because like it made him think about the answer opposed to like, I can't just give a canned response on this. So that was pretty interesting. I did ask him about recruiting. Probably should have used the phrase directly, shopping down a different aisle, because he was like not overly defensive about it, more complimentary of Marcus. But then it was like, but I also got a bunch of five stars at LSU. And I'm like, well, that's not really the point. So, yeah, I think that he even if he didn't articulate directly, he sees like, look, Marcus is taking a place, Notre Dame to a place where I couldn't get it. Also, I think Notre Dame is more motivated to get to that place now that because he left, if that makes sense.
I'm just going to follow up before you talk about this one, JB, because Wash ND had a question directly related to some of what you said there, Pete. So we won't save it for the second segment. When you think about ND football recruiting and talent accumulation just 5 years ago under BK and how ND was perceived nationally and by players, have you witnessed a more stark paradigm shift in your lifetime as to how ND is viewed now by fans, recruits, and media? And I think this is important, including the postseason expectations that come along with it.
I mean, that's the postseason expectations carries the day there.
Yes.
Because I think you could have a discussion about like, hey, the change of Notre Dame football from the end of Charlie Weiss to year three of Brian Kelly, that was pretty severe. But I don't want to minimize what he did. I just think it's easier to go from like bad to good than it is from good to great. And I think Marcus is doing the good to great thing right now. So yeah, and just the likability of Notre Dame, like BK didn't make Notre Dame any more likable than it was under Charlie Weiss. So that is powerful as well. So I think that I would agree with Washington D's premise that like this is the starkest change from like one coach to another in terms of how Notre Dame is perceived.
And I would contend also along with all that perception is the fact, particularly in 2024, that Notre Dame went and beat Texas A&M, Georgia, and Penn State all away from Notre Dame Stadium. And so you had tangible results to go with a charismatic head coach. As good as Kyron Williams was and remains now today in the NFL, he wasn't this affable, marketable guy the way that Jeremiah Love is, talking about his comic books and writing his own superhero comic book and just with the charisma and the candor and the cussing in interviews that Jeremiah Love had that kind of amused us all. So I think there's been a perfect recipe of ingredients for Notre Dame to have elevated, but certainly the main one would be Marcus Freeman and his vision for the program and then the support for the program that has become much more Big Ten and SEC like in the last few years. And Jack Swarbrick may have talked about wanting to win a national championship, but Pete Bevacqua told a gathering of like 300 Notre Dame employees last fall, we absolutely need to win a national championship in football. I think that's significant when your AD goes and tells the people that are out there working for you, we don't want to do this. We need to do this in our football program, and we need to do it for the university.
I want to circle back. I agree with your Jeremiah Love point, but it's worth noting Notre Dame was when Kyron Williams was involved with NIL. They wouldn't tell anybody sure. somebody was getting NIL, so he might have been a pretty marketable guy, but man, Mike Mayer wouldn't even answer, and you knew he had a deal. Yeah, Pete, and when Wash ND said the postseason expectations, for Bavakwa to say that, but also for all of us to say, including BK, Marcus has taken them to a point where Brian Kelly couldn't have, he has to still take them there.
Yeah. Yeah, he's there.
You know, 13-2 is not taking them to a point Brian Kelly didn't take them at the end of this year. That would not be taking them there. I think 15-1 might be if you're playing for another championship, but that point still has to get there. Just to wrap up on BK, was there any, this is from Otzer Poll, one of our subscribers. If Pete is on, Pete, did any of BK's responses surprise you?
Not really. I thought Fortuna did an awesome job at the end asking about the Kelsey Swift wedding, because it was one of those BK things where he's like, I knew that I probably shouldn't attend that. And then Fortuna was like, well, were you invited? And he's like, no, I wasn't. So that, I enjoyed that. I think the rest of it, it was pretty standard BK. I mean, maybe, you know, I've still got my season tickets. I hadn't heard him come out. And I know, John, he went on your podcast and that was a little bit more like forward thinking opposed to ours, which was more like looking at Notre Dame. You know, I hadn't heard him say like, I'm 100% supportive of Notre Dame. Like I want Notre Dame to be good, to win. I want to support Marcus. So I think he was more direct about that. It didn't surprise me, but I just thought it was worth mentioning.
Yeah. When he visited with us both in an interview form and then subsequent to that, the USA Today podcast, he talked about coming back to visit Marcus this summer. And he was also, again, very candid in saying, like, we rebuilt it to a certain level and Marcus has taken it to a greater level than that. I think that's literally the exact quote. So he's steadfast in acknowledging that Notre Dame football has reached a further elevated tier than the very good tier that he got it back to.
That time of year, everybody wants to know who has jumped out at you. We don't know who has jumped out yet from the summer. We do know that Marcus Freeman will speak with the media officially on August 4th. So that is the official start of Notre Dame's training camp. We're not to divulge the list over the last few years of practices, but we can say that we'll be in attendance for the first practice there on August 6th. That is our lone full viewing, Pete Sampson. Speaking of BK, used to get more viewings under Pete Sampson, but we do get more interviews under many more interviews under Marcus Freeman, but one full practice viewing. No longer a surprise, unless Notre Dame opens up with IUSB, I think we will always be getting one full August practice viewing from now on.
Probably so. I do miss that one at school field from a couple years ago, because that's like, your pads are on, you're a little bit more into it. That was sort of, I think, the first day we're like, ooh, Jordan Faison, like something's going on here. So it stinks that we don't get that opportunity. I don't think that would give any trade secrets away, but you know what? I'm not a football coach, so it is what it is. As far as who has jumped out in summer workouts, I don't really have an answer for you on this one. I can just tell you that a story that I'm working on for next week at The Athletic is I actually worked out with Lauren Landau yesterday. So, but it was not me. I did not jump out to anyone in the Notre Dame weight room. But it was fun.
You might have stuck out actually being.
Yeah, I was working out by myself. But that will be a fun story because Lauren really sort of pulled the curtain back on like the stuff that they do and had me go through that warm up that we watch all the time and our eyes glaze over. And actually it's much harder to do although I think you're probably when you're a 48-year-old non-athlete that might have something to do with it. But yeah, it was great. I learned a lot. So that'll be a fun story to do for next week at The Athletic.
How long was the workout?
I was in there for an hour and I was very, very sweaty at the end of it. He worked me out. He did not take it easy. He complimented my ankle flexibility, which I have never felt better about my ankles than when Lauren Landau said they were very flexible.
That's a win.
JB's testing his ankles out right now, wondering why they're so tight.
I am. Yeah, the ankles.
Full disclosure, my ankle stability was awful, and he pointed that out as well.
Yeah. That means you were an athlete. See, there you go, Pete. So Pete Sampson gets 1 hour of dynamic stretching, and we get to watch 20 minutes of it. It's like the old Charlie Weiss days. We're back to watching these practices. All right, guys, you're going to, JB and Pete, you're obviously not part of the Irish Illustrated Countdown panel, so you guys get to do what every fan likes to do to us and tell us where we were wrong. All right, I'm just going to go with the last week, okay? The last week at Irish Illustrated, this is in the aggregate. These are not my personal rankings, though. It was close. Nolan James, 25. Luke Talich, 24. DJ McKinney, Jason Onyeka, Ashton Craig, hard to rank because you're assuming he doesn't play the entire season, I think, at that spot. Maybe we'll leave him out of it. Jalen Sneed, Will Black, Cooper Flanagan, and today, not to spoil anything, I don't think I will, it should pop up first, is Teyon Gray.
Oh, I wonder if that was Christian Gray when he Gray in the outline.
Today, yeah.
All right, well, then my initial takeaways are you have Black and Flanagan too low. You have Teyon Gray too high. And then I suspect Nolan James will be too low, but I can't pound the table for him before he's really done anything. So Sneed is a wild card to me. I feel like he could be 12 or 32 at the end.
Yeah, I'm surprised that Sneed landed at the 20 spot in your all's, five-man voting or something, I think it is.
Yep, it was Drew Mentok, Eric Thomas, Priester, Thomas Willer, and myself.
Yeah, so that's probably it for me. And Will Black, you know, if he hits the level we've all heard, then I would think Will Black would be a top 14-ish player for the Irish. But and then, yeah, Teyon Gray, like the frame is probably number 17, or you could argue the frame might be number 7 in terms of frames, but you have to see it all happen. So anyway, I feel like the 17 is graded on potential or ranked on potential, and that's fair.
Yeah. Looks like Zwiller and Eric Thomas were higher on Will Black than the rest of us, and Mentok was a little higher. Nope, I'm going to misquote him there. Mentok was the highest on Jalen Sneed. I had him exactly where he landed at 20. Sneed's an interesting one because when I was going, I kind of wrote it knowing what I know about him, predisposed to my own ranking. And then I looked at how much better statistical year he had in 2024 than 2025, and I started thinking, it is a different coordinator and scheme. Like, maybe 20 is high for Jalen Sneed here. It's just that he's a healthy guy. Kings of Viliamu also not all the way back yet. So I was kind of looking at Sneed as a start.
Do you do a postseason of this?
We do, yes. Okay. Usually it's Tim and I finish off, but we do a top
25.
We do whoever's good is what we do. But I think in 2024, we got to top 50. And last year, I was just top 40. They didn't play enough games also last year for any of that. So, yeah, that's all right. Well, you guys. Oh, and Nolan James for Drew Mentok was way up to the point where some subscribers wondered if he knew something we didn't know. Because Nolan James is in the top 13, I believe.
Which was
Drew Mentok. Yeah. That's. I had an E.S. Williams pretty high, so I couldn't do that. I've had an E.S. Williams pretty high for 4 years, maybe. So it's hard for me to lower now.
He was your number one, right?
Yeah. I bet Mentok has Jordan Faison higher than anybody.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did. We all had Faison higher, but he did a write-in vote for AA1 to see if it could somehow sway the rankings to get him number one overall. That did not work. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question, longtime subscriber, not Jay Tafel. With the rise of NIL, the portal, and general managers, has the profile of an ideal assistant coach changed? We used to debate between hiring an elite recruiter or an elite teacher developer. In today's game, does having assistant coaches who are top recruiters matter as much anymore? Or has player development become the more valuable skill?
Really, this is one of the best questions of the summer. I love this. Which Jay Tafel is a regular, or not Jay Tafel, whatever, is a regular supplier of interrogatives. But I would contend, and I just had this discussion with multiple coaches at that symposium I attended in Atlanta the last weekend of June, that the single most important hire now is general manager for any coach taking over a program. And then me and several of the coaches and some members of search firms and athletic directors actually kind of had some open discussions about whether or not it's general manager or strength coach. But in the last two cycles, particularly the 25 and 26 cycles, so maybe a little over 2 years, but those two cycles specific, the trend has been much more who is going to be your general manager and how many players are you going to bring into this rebuild that almost every new hiring situation is. And so because of that, I think that your general manager and your personnel staff trump a lot of that in terms of player acquisition. And then you're looking at your staff based on fit and the culture you want to identify as the head coach and the program leader, and you kind of go from there. But it's definitely radically changed from even 2020, whereas I would have immediately, because of my past time at both Rivals and 247, said, no, you have to answer. You have to get the recruiter first and then find an analyst or a GA who can also help supplement as your player developer, because every coach will tell you it's the Jimmys and Joes, not the X's and O's. And there's still that, but there's just different ways to acquire the Jimmys and Joes. So hope that I'm answering that question adequately for not Jay Tafel, but I just think that this has been a fresh conversation topic. And it was more, I had a very similar conversation with 14 of the 16 Big 12 head coaches last week in Frisco about how they distribute the money on their roster, about how they assemble their roster, whether they're going to go portal heavy, how they navigate the portal heavy. And again, like a couple of the head coaches told me, their roster construction is strictly 100% them and the general manager. And then everything flows from that.
I agree with all that. It's changed a lot. I would say an addendum to what John said. I think the way the recruiting impact of coordinators has dropped considerably just based on how they're used as recruiters. Not that they don't get out on the road, but I think you're seeing more and more programs send GAs, like assistant assistants, out on the road more than coordinators, or sort of augmenting or giving the coordinators a break from that kind of stuff. So I think you still got to have like big time relationship guys on your staff. But I think the coaches that you hear recruits mention now, they're much more like Trey Reeder than they are Chris Ash. And that's not to say both aren't important, but I think you need sort of those relationship, hey, we're on Instagram together type coaches as well. And that's not always your Mike Denbrock of the world.
But I think go ahead, Jimmy.
Just real quickly, that's an excellent point, Pete, because I think from talking with people on campus that Trey Reeder was critical in the Roman Igwabike recruitment and ultimately nailing down that commitment. So, and we've seen, that's one other point I meant to make as I was first answering that question and naturally lost my train of thought because it's early in the morning. And that is, not even most of the assistant coaches are recruiting out on the road less than ever before. I mean, now for this, at least the second year in a row, maybe the third year in a row, none of Notre Dame's coordinators went out on the road. Not Denbrock, not Ash, not Marty during the spring eval period. And there are more of those doing that. Not everybody is doing that the way Marcus has approached it. Notre Dame has taken a direct NFL approach in that regard to, like, we're going to send our personnel people out to look at the personnel, and our coaches are going to stay behind. Then we're going to work on opponents and game plan and prepare for the coming season and prepare our team.
Think about how different that was from Chip Long. Chip Long was Elko was like a dogged recruiter on the road. So that's like that skill set. It's not that it doesn't matter, but it's just they found someone else to do it.
What I find intriguing is freshmen like Bubba Frazier saying, I looked at Mike Denbrock's film to see if I want, they talk to people to see if Mike Denbrock is a good fit for their skill set. That was not a thing. I mean, now you're looking at, he even said, like, you know, yeah, you watch the 2024 team and they're running so much. I'm like, why am I being recruited here if they're going to run this much? Well, then somebody has to tell you it's Riley Leonard's offense. It's not always going to be like that. So I think it's interesting. Players scout coordinators now. I also find it, Pete, you've always said you're not sure if you need to be recruiting or development heavy, but the running back coach better be recruiting heavy, because it's much better to have Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price running around back there than
Jaywan Sider's still out on the road a lot.
Yes, trying to figure out if your running back can be good or not, because you're going to develop him to be Jeremiah Love. They don't really develop that way to be Jeremiah Love. Next question, Pete's favorite Twitter handle here, from Happy Keith Gilmore. What is your favorite stat? And conversely, what is a stupid, lazy stat sports writers still use?
I love rush efficiency. O'Malley, I know you're a devotee of that as well. I think it's a simple way to understand whether your run game is working or not. I hate total offense and total defense. If anyone uses that, I'm just like, what are you doing? What a waste of time.
I think for me, it's probably red zone touchdown percentage, both offense and defense. I think that tells a lot about how your season's going and about how many games you've got a chance to win. And every team has some pretty high metrics that they want to achieve offensively, and they want to mitigate touchdowns defensively. And if if you're effective in the red zone, that's where the most games are won and lost. You know, time of possession, I still think has a spot, but it's in many ways less important than ever before. I certainly know some coaches that have talked to me about that, and I've maybe cited time of possession on a podcast and they've taken issue with it. And that's fine. Like, I get it. I also know, like, if your offense has the ball, it puts so much pressure on the other team's offense on the rare occasions they get the ball, but that's presuming your defense is providing a modicum of wet paper defense.
Red zone touchdown percentage is very high and rush efficiency super high, but I can't understand it. So it's not easy because it's a formula. Pass efficiency defense is maybe the most important stat there is, because nowadays with all the passing, nothing to do with passing yards, but pass efficiency defense. And I think third and fourth, now you have to include them both. You have to include fourth down conversion rate, third and fourth down, because that's what keeps drives alive and really lends itself to everything in there offensively and defensively. Pressure rate is good, but it's another one we can't just look at and know what's going on. Pressure rate. I think the best one you can look at, raw number, is turnovers created. I mean, it doesn't always go from year to year because maybe some defenses don't play that way, but there's no such thing as a bad football team that created 22 turnovers and suffered five.
On third down and fourth down, I love breaking it out by like yardage. And then they put it in Notre Dame's game notes that way now too, because that's way more informative than just like this bulk percentage of like, well, you're in third and two a lot. Like, yeah, Navy's third down percentage is awesome. Doesn't mean they're great on third and eight.
Right, right. And actually, it's pretty important to see how many times you're in third and eight.
Yeah, because that gets into rush efficiency, right? It's like, are you staying ahead of the chains or not? That's, I think, the most important. Although I think you could make an argument for like explosive play rate is more important now than maybe it used to be.
Well, you don't have to.
I'm not sure I have a great way to like track that. But
no, they have raw numbers.
People way better than me on that.
The college football stats has the raw numbers of who has the most 10, 20, 30, 40.
Right.
They don't tell you when it happened. I mean, I'm using Jadarian Price because he was a great breakaway back. But if Jadarian Price is a bunch of 20-yard runs when Notre Dame's up 45, it didn't really matter as much.
No offense, but Ineas Williams' runs last year. Like,
yeah.
Okay, there were explosive runs that didn't really matter.
And then the one stat that's got to go away in college football, it's fine in the NFL, rushing yards per game or rushing average, because they count sacks.
Oh, yeah, it's so bad.
Sacks, you have to do sack adjusted.
Yeah, you know, it would be awesome if for the podcast we had Notre Dame analytics guru Anthony Tresh see which stats he really finds valuable and which ones.
We'll search this out. That's a good idea.
Yeah, so he and Matt Jansen would be very, very valuable to glean insight from them for that. As we shift to question number three, and it's not Scrap a Coco this time because he got his question answered last week. It is Maltese Irish, although we should have reread that question for Pete and made him answer it as well about NIL and why they can't go all in specifically for men's basketball as they've done for football. But anyway, Maltese Irish, in your time covering the Irish, T.O. and Pete, whether it be film, your personal projection, or recruiting hoopla, name one player you thought was a can't-miss stud that ultimately didn't come close to panning out for Notre Dame. Timothy O'Malley, the floor is yours.
The hard part here is can't-miss stud, because you miss on one or two guys every single cycle that you think is going to be good, that you almost accept blindly will be good. But can't-miss stud, Max Redfield.
Mm.
Does he count because he played too much, though?
No, he definitely counts.
I thought
I didn't think he was a can't miss stud out of high school. Aaron Lynch, I thought, was a can't miss stud out of high school. Yes. That's the guy I was like, this might be the best defensive player I've covered in Notre Dame. And obviously he transferred, but it's not like he went to USF and was just like a two-time All-American. Like his career fizzled out. So he was very few guys.
There's not a can't miss in high school. Every cycle. There's not a can't miss.
No, there's not. Can't miss or like sure thing is very overused by recruiting analysts. Michael Floyd was a sure thing.
Michael Mayer
was a sure thing. Kyle Rudolph was a sure thing. And I had a coach tell me that CJ Carr was a sure thing.
And I would say Jalen Smith and Manti Te'o were sure things.
Correct. Yeah.
You wouldn't say that at Jeremiah Owusu-Koroboa. He's my number one sleeper ever, but he was not a sure thing.
You wouldn't
say
that at Jeremiah Love for sure.
No. Yeah. Jalen Smith was absolutely a sure thing.
I have obviously exponentially shallower perspective than the two of you, but I just remember Phil Jakovic and what a big get he was for Notre Dame at the time. And my brother-in-law is just a massive ND fan and was following recruiting then. So even though I was down in Tennessee and working primarily in the SEC at that time, I just remember so much buzz about Jakovic and just the hype that he brought with him and what a huge get it was for Notre Dame. And he was going to be a multi-year starter and all of that. And I'm not saying he was hyped the way that Beano Cooke hyped Ron Pallas, but that's, you know, that was kind of a modern equivalent for me.
Yeah. I like that one. Every quarterback that has ever signed, I don't think is a can't miss stud. And I always rank them lower than I would if it was a different position, because I think it's really hard to play that spot, except for CJ Carr. DJ Carr was the only one I was like, he's the best one since Clausen. If I'm wrong here, I'm totally wrong here. This is ridiculous. There's no way. And I didn't have KVA was still number one in that class. Like, KVA was a can't miss stud, don't you think? Kingston Biliamuwassa?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, he was a can't miss stud. They had a couple in that class. But it's hard to do it with quarterbacks because, I mean, they had...
It's too many variables.
It's way too many. Like, for Dane Crist, there's just too many variables. Next question. GR Irish Fan 22. Which offensive and defensive player would you say is at a crossroads of it being time to, quote, put up or shut up as far as seeing meaningful playing time this year? And I guess as a result, not seeing it next year if he doesn't put up.
Well, I guess this wouldn't apply to not seeing it next year because there won't be a next year. But Jaden Greyhouse and Christian Gray are both my answer to both those.
Mine was definitively Jaden Greyhouse, to the point that I almost referenced Jaden Greyhouse on our previous question. Just because I'd talked to so many people in Texas when he was coming out of Texas and signed with Notre Dame. And then we saw just the briefest glimpse of it, but in the most memorable season of Notre Dame football in the last 15-ish years and in the playoff run of 2024. So definitely have Jaden Greyhouse for sure right there on the offensive side of the ball, on the defensive side of the ball, even though it's his first year in the program. It's a significant year for Keon Keeley because of Notre Dame's familiarity with him going back to his recruiting days and how long he was committed to the Irish and how much Notre Dame coveted him. And now they have him. And, you know, I think he'll be a guy for Notre Dame and a very valuable rotational piece. I don't get any sense he's going to be the dude for Notre Dame.
Offensively, I mean, Greathouse is the call, but I'm going to go with the, you get passed if you don't put up Micah Gilbert. It's time for Micah Gilbert. If you enter the spring and exit the spring as the default boundary, it's not staying default forever. They don't have to do that way. I mean, they can move Jaden Greyhouse to boundary if they have to. Quincy Porter could be there. So Micah Gilbert would be mine there. And it's his third year. It's fair. It's in his third year. Keeley's a great answer on this one. And it's not fair. I know Bryce Young is a thought people are going to have on our message board. He was better than people give him credit for last year, like more productive. He just wasn't what we thought he would be. Like, we hyped Bryce Young as, God, did you see him as a freshman? He's going to be an All-American as a sophomore. He was fine. So it's not put up or shut up because he's going to have a great senior year. But I don't have Bryce Young needs to be much better than – he needs to be what we were thinking he could be 2 years – like, he needs to jump to that level.
That's a great point, and I don't have the last year's stats directly in front of me, but I think Bryce Young was among the team leaders in quarterback hurries. So
He was.
You know, he showed some effectiveness.
We thought he'd be like the team leader in quarterback kills and all that kind of thing. So it was
We thought there would be a point where he would just suplex a quarterback.
Yes. Our next question is actually a two-parter. I'm going to read the first part first because it's very cordial. From N. Gale, how's your guys' week been? Good, bad, neither, or both? One word answer, Pete Sampson. How's it been? Both. I love this question. It's fantastic.
Oh, it's definitely a both kind of week.
It is a both kind of week. JB?
I'm going to go with pretty solid. Some new tires. Met an Irish Illustrated subscriber out here. Got some coaches on the phone. Got a major story out today at USA Today. Update on the Protect College Sports Act, which we know Notre Dame is staunchly in favor of. So pretty compelling read there with even some exclusive comments from Senator Ted Cruz. So anyway. Yeah, solid week, but man, I'm looking for the weekend.
I'm going to quote Ben Stiller and his portfolio and Meet the Parents, strong to very strong. That has been my week. Part two is a phenomenal Twitter handle from Brian's Missing Statue. I'm just here because Pete never asked BK about his pending statue. But in all seriousness, what's the most inappropriate or dubious question, at least in retrospect, you've ever asked a coach? It could have been outside a formal setting.
Not true. I have asked Brian about his statue before. However, it was like in 2018. And it was a question about legacy. And I said, like, you know what it takes to get a statue here. And he's like, I know. And like, if I don't get one, like, I will be at peace with that. But like, so the statue has come up in discourse with him before, just not the way that Brian's specific statue means it. I was trying to think of like a question I asked. I was just like, man, that was really pushing the limits, or I was just being a prick. The only thing I could think of, I think it was after the Purdue game in 2012, and they shut down like media access. Yes. And like Zach Barton came in, and I think I phrased it like Everett Golson should have come in and didn't.
Only Zach Martin came in.
Yeah, he's the freaking quarterback at Notre Dame. And I think I phrased the question to Zach Martin. This is probably a better question for Everett, but ... as a protest question. But I'm sure there's something I've asked a coach where he's just like, you're a Jag. And like Brian Kelly, I'm sure has some examples of this, including like after the Alabama game, when I think I asked like, what's the next best, what's your first next steps after this? Cause then we're told they're much closer to Alabama now than they were Clemson or Alabama before. And he just like went off on me over Zoom about like the local press is not giving us any support, yada, yada. So, but I thought that question was totally fair. So doesn't really count here.
I got a few that popped to mind. One, and credit to him because he took it masterfully and I'll ride out of it. But last week I asked Joey McGuire what he would change in his recruiting protocol out of the transfer portal after dealing with Brendan Sorsby. Mm-hmm. And he was a super pro, and it's a fair question, but I didn't mean I was looking forward to asking it, but I would have been a pretty craptastic journalist had I not asked it. One other time, one of my favorite times is Derek Dooley was in a spat with Justin Hunter when Hunter was a star all SEC wide receiver and getting ready to become a second round NFL pick. And he had some first round grades, and somebody asked Derek Dooley about his draft prospects. And he's like, he's good. I don't think he's ready yet. Like, he wouldn't be the first receiver I would draft. And this was pretty early in social media era, maybe 2010, 11, something like that. And Hunter got really mad and popped off on social media about how he thought we were family and all of this. And Dooley hadn't seen it. And I saw him after practice for a different interview for something I was working on. And I was just like, hey, you probably have some fences to mend with Justin Hunter. And he was like, I didn't say anything, guys. And, you know, he had that voice. And he's like, guys, what are we doing? I didn't say anything. And I just said, coach, you know, like, don't take this the wrong way, but you're probably coaching in an era where you should have been coaching with your dad instead of being his son and coaching 30 years later. I said, because when your dad coached Georgia, Justin Hunter would have gone out to practice after you made those comments and caught every ball and told you to stick it up your ass. And now players go to social media. And Dooley's media guy was walking with us, and he turns to him and he goes, Jimmy, you hear how he talks to me? And Jimmy Stanton, now at Oregon and just a titan in athletic communications, a fabulous man, looked at him and goes, coach, you better be glad he likes you. So when I saw this question, I knew I was telling that story. It was a little lengthy, but I appreciate the indulgence.
The most awkward I felt, not oddly, was with John Tenuta, because I happened to ask the first question about Ian Williams saying they got out schemed next week. And that was received about as well as all of Tim Priester's questions were to John Tenuta. Tim Priester normally went first. Somehow I went first that time. One that hit, I think it would have hit a lot better with BK had I known him more. Pete, do you remember he used to talk about his recruiting where he would, every once in a while, he would see someone that does not fit the profile. He would be like the off-platform recruit that he just looked at and thought, that's the type of guy I want to bring in here. And he'd have like the one exception and all of this.
Off-profile, yeah.
Off-profile. And he was talking about his time at Assumption playing linebacker. And I said, so I assume you were that off-profile recruit that they took for no reason like that. And like, people laughed and he kind of laughed, but I think it might have gone a lot better had I asked him that like on your independent podcast than that day. It was 2010, so felt a little awkward at that one. And then Mike Bray, you could say anything too, but I asked Mike Bray if, I'm not going to talk about the player now because he has passed, but I asked Mike Bray, it was not in public, if the guy deserved to get punched because he got punched in a game. He gave me a look like, you know, I can't answer that. But he also gave me the look like, yeah, he probably did.
Yeah, he probably deserved to get punched.
Question number six, and I think there's a conspiracy here because this is the second or third time this summer I've read a question from this particular username Brokeback Brian.
I definitely seek you out for these, JB.
Yes, Brokeback Brian. And there's only one correct answer for this question, by the way. O'Malley and Priester often talk about Notre Dame's three-man front versus Texas in 2016 as a counterpoint to trust the coaches, a.k.a. clearly that was stupid, harebrained, moronic, you name it. What are some other examples in which we, the fan base, should not have blindly accepted that coaches are always right? And in parentheses, especially since one side always loses, sometimes stupidly loses said argument. Pete, let's start with you because I opened with O'Malley and I want to hopefully see you take his answer.
I got two answers here. One of them isn't scheme at all. It's Brian Kelly's chopping down a different aisle, like putting a ceiling on recruiting. Because I think at the time I was like, yeah, I kind of get what he's saying. Like, I'm not going to blindly accept this, but like, I agree with you. Obviously, that was wrong. The other one is the kicking situation last year. Like, Marty Biaggi is a really good special teams coach. It was like, oh, you know, they'll figure it out. That, you know, surely they'll be able to make an extra point. Like, they'll get the field goal game figured out. Like, I trust the coaches on this. Like, that was a disaster. So those would be two examples for me.
I thought Pete might take my answer because he was sitting next to me in the Notre Dame press box during a Purdue game where Notre Dame, same Purdue game to Pete Sam. So this came to Purdue 2012.
Oh, my God. Nice.
We were looking down. Yeah, we were looking down. It was 4th and 10 at the 15-yard line, and Purdue needed a touchdown. And Carlo Calabrese was in the base 3-4, still guarding Antavian Edison, because Notre Dame at that point was not using a nickel. They decided they didn't need a nickel against Navy, which is true, but they didn't use a nickel against Purdue in the passing, and that was the most obvious touchdown we've ever seen. That is not trusting coaching. That's call timeout. I'm not going to throw the Al Golden one on here because the one, you know, the double safety blitz.
Oh, yeah, Tariq, that was bad.
I still feel like he had time to know Tariq Bracey was hurt and not put in Jaden Mickey there, but that was due to injury. But on the same realm, and if Priester listens to this podcast, he's going to enjoy it. 2011, my main man, Robert Woods, split out wide. Jamoris Slaughter goes out to a concussion, and backup Low Wood runs out there on 3rd and 1 to cover Robert Woods. And everybody in the press, we're all like, it's Low Wood. Low Wood's on Robert Woods. Low Wood, somebody call timeout. Someone call timeout. Matt Barkley touchdown to Robert Woods. So yeah, you got to have a little situational awareness when you're a coordinator as well.
I'm going the entire final possession of the 2023 Ohio State game inside Notre Dame Stadium. But even more importantly, I'm going to the micro level and I'm taking not switching the coverage on Jeremiah Smith in the national championship game and giving up the bomb that sealed Notre Dame's fate.
That's a tough one. Leonard Moore can go over there. Christian Gray will be previewed soon, and he talked quite a bit about that this spring. Next question from ND Irish Berg. I think a 2014 playoff is too many, but I do think it's inevitable. That being said, would a lousy playoff game, which will happen, still be better than a lousy bowl game? It would keep players in the game and give it some meaning. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it'd be better. I don't know how long it will be better, but it would be better to start. It wouldn't. Players opting out of 2014 playoff bowl games doesn't seem like I think that will happen. I don't think it will happen right away, but I think at some point it will happen. But regardless, if the Camping World Bowl was a playoff game and it was Notre Dame versus Iowa State, it would be a lot more interesting than it turned out to be in the Camping World Bowl.
Hey, as previewed on our podcast last Thursday and written on USA Today Monday of this week, you could put the bowl games week 0 and eliminate the problem of guys sitting out. And so that story is out there. It's on my Twitter as well. So if you're bored or...
We had odd pushback on our board against that, JB, because I am 100% with you on that notion.
Yeah.
And that thread. Yeah.
I had coaches who saw the story that reached out to me and were like, we really like this. That's a good idea. So, you know, I knew it would not be universal, but I do like that idea. The 2014 playoff is better. The Bulls are incredibly worried, as I alluded to. They spent time last week in Frisco. They're bowl reps with the ACC media days this week. There will be bowl reps in Tampa, I think, for SEC media days coming up. And there will be bowl reps in Chicago at month's end for Big Ten media days, trying to figure out what their existence is going to look like. But yeah, 2014 playoff, you presumably would have 8 to 12 of those teams hosting games on campus. That would be spectacular. So yeah, I think so. And to say whether or not you would eventually have players opting out of playoff games in a 2014 setting, I would push back only mildly to say it all depends on whether or not college athletics reaches a point of collective bargaining. And if there's collective bargaining, then no players will be sitting out 24-team playoff games because there will be employment status and contract status and everything else involved there officially, not just, oh yeah, well, the contract says this and we can't say that you get money for carrying the ball X number of times or whatever, but if you're featured on the game 35 times, you're going to make $250,000 that day.
Our final question from Memphis Phil. With games in Lambeau, Provo, Chapel Hill, and Foxborough, where does this rank travel-wise for you guys as a season?
I tried to rank the last 10 years of travel schedules. And
that's
this
podcast homework, Pete Sampson. I like it.
This was tied for 10th.
I knew it was going to be low.
With 2020, which feels like kind of this weird travel year, because that was like you didn't want to travel anywhere for obvious reasons. Like, I cannot wait to get to Lambeau. I think it's going to be awesome. I really like BYU. I don't mind Purdue. I like the one night Big Ten road game. Syracuse just freaking kills it in November. So that's, I mean, look at 2018.
Yes.
Wake Forest. Okay, that's fine. Like, at Virginia Tech for the first time. So that was novel. San Diego, Chicago, New York City, LA.
No, I wrote 2018. That was by far the best. Although Tyler James, then of the ND Insider, and I missed our night with any of our friends separately in New York City due to a snowstorm that kept us. But yeah, that's the number one for me, Pete Sampson, 2018. I want to point out that Notre Dame's original 2020 schedule was Dublin, Lambeau Field, Pittsburgh, Charlotte for the NFL stadium, USC. So everybody stepped back on what, and Wake Forest, which is the only one that kept. That was the schedule of all time, and it was never repeated that way. I mean, last year was better. The Fayetteville trip was fun. I was looking forward to that for years.
That was fun.
Fayetteville trip at Stanford. Yeah, this is low. Also, anytime you're throwing in like some combination of Michigan, Michigan State, Purdue, it offsets things too when you're driving to those, because you're driving there and driving back. And even though JB can get you to Purdue and back in an hour and 6 minutes or something like that, it's still not quite worth it.
We cover some real estate and we do it efficiently, if not illegally. You know, I'm going to agree with Pete in ranking this 10, even though I don't have the depth there to, or the travel stamps to officially rank it 10th, but it also ranks number one for me this year, because I know that all season long there's going to be a drumbeat of O'Malley saying, well, you guys will be at Syracuse and I'll be in Manhattan Beach. So because of that, because I know that O'Malley is bent on going to Manhattan Beach Post, and because I got to
TVs. They have TVs. People not named us cover games on TV all the time. I'm going to do it. There's no.
And because I got to even torment you with a picture from there earlier this year, because the lovely Jess Bryce had work in the area and I tagged along. Yeah, so this year is both number one and number 10 simultaneously for me, and enjoy that paradox.
It's number 10, but still quite good.
Yeah, because Lambeau's awesome and Provo's a treat. It's just Chapel Hill we like. Foxborough's exciting. I'm glad it's not back in BC. I love going to Boston last year.
Boston's good.
But it's, you know, I want to go to Foxborough. Yeah.
North Carolina's kind of whatever.
Notre Dame is great. I like to go to Carolina at least every other year, every third year, though. It's when you go every year and then you go twice some years. It's a little too much. But that's always a good place.
During hurricane season as well.
I was going to say, we love it. We often travel during hurricane season, so that should be fun. This was fun as well. And programming note for next week before we sign off. No Monday podcast, because there will be a Marcus Freeman interview. There's two interview sessions. Pete is in my group as well. I won't divulge everything else. Pete is in our group next week. So Tim Priester and I, and Pete, you're welcome to join if you don't have one for the Independent. Tim Priester and I are going to go straight to a later Tuesday afternoon podcast post Freeman, because it seems weird to do a Monday one when we're talking to Freeman on Tuesday. And then we will have our normal Thursday podcast. So everybody that has read what Marcus said and listened to the podcast can ask questions after that. JB, you've already spoken with Marcus, so you're not allowed to come to this one. Seems fair enough.
Seems completely fair. No issues with me.
For John Bryce of USA Today, Pete Sampson of The Athletic, I am Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening. Irish Illustrated Insider.